Good morning, everyone. I'm Jeff Swanson from the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Duke University School of Medicine. I have no relationships to disclose. I'd like to introduce my topic this morning by showing you a picture of a structure that I like to call the Magical Public Health Law Research Staircase. This is pretty cool, and I'll show you how this works. Over here, you start with some evidence of legal efficacy. You've got a good idea. This actually worked pretty well in the Netherlands or in, you know, the San Francisco Health Department. So you write about it, and people read it, and, you know, it gets Facebooked and tweeted around, and you get some buzz, and pretty soon you get some calls from some state legislatures, and, you know, they pass this law in a whole bunch of states. This is the law that you're recommending, and it gets implemented throughout the land, and before you know it, there is this meaningful improvement in an important population health outcome, and people start behaving in healthier ways just because they think that's a good thing to do, and you study the real-world effectiveness of that, and it's just wonderful, because you've not only improved health and made the world a better place, you have contributed to a culture of health and a culture of evidence-based policymaking. So how does this work? Well, you know, that marble there is your efficacy study, and you just nudge it a little bit, and it rolls right down the staircase, just like that. If you want to see that once again, just roll it right down the staircase, and there it is. And you say, that's wonderful. It's fantastic, and of course it is. But that doesn't mean it bears any relationship to reality, which is why we call it the Magical Public Health Law Research Staircase. The real staircase looks a little bit like this, with your marble down there at the bottom, and you have to push it up the staircase. So you write your article, and it gets read by an editor and two reviewers and your mother and a guy in Finland whose library doesn't subscribe to the North Carolina Journal of Pretty Good Ideas in Public Health Law, so you send him a PDF. But, you know, so nobody reads it. But, you know, you're kind of discouraged, and you'd think about this for a minute, but then all of a sudden, there's some, just when you're least expecting it, there's just some awful thing that happens, and here comes this crisis-driven law flying in from right field. You had nothing to do with this, but that doesn't stop you from crawling up there and claiming credit for it. Then you take a look at this. It's not quite the law that you thought it should be. It's a little hasty, it's a little maybe overreaching, and it's got some, you know, maybe some perverse incentives, and it might have some adverse consequences, and it conflicts with another statute, and it's just a tad unconstitutional. But that doesn't really matter. It turns out not to be a problem because, nobody implements it. So it's not implemented. You're kind of discouraged. Bottom of the staircase again, and then all of a sudden you read this article in the New York Times, and some reporter has gotten some data, some, you know, records from somewhere, and, you know, has done this study. You kind of wish you did it, but he wrote it in the newspaper. And there's some change vaguely related to health, and you think it might have to do with this law, and so you go up there and take credit for that, too. Now you think, I'm going to do some research on this. So you submit an application to the RWJF Public Health Law Research Program, and you say, this is a critical opportunity. Well, you don't really have a great measure of a population health outcome. You know, you don't really have a measure of a mediator or really much of a, you know, data to speak of, but you are a good writer and you submit it and, you know, it gets nerfed. And so you call up Scott Burris and you say, give me some feedback here. And you don't come away from that conversation feeling much better about yourself. So, you know, you give up and you say, there must be an easier way for a professor like me, self-respecting professor, to earn a living, and there probably is. But I'm going to talk about that. But let me give you some examples. That sounds cynical, but it's not far off. So here's a big public health problem. We have millions of people in the United States with serious and disabling psychiatric disorders going without treatment. And we probably have, arguably because of that, on any given day in our biggest city jails, more people with serious mental illnesses than we ever had in the biggest asylum in the 20th century. Now, can evidence-based law fix that? Well, you know, if you're Representative Tim Murphy from Pennsylvania, yeah, you say, okay, we can do that with the law. H.R. 3717, Helping Families in the Mental Health Crisis Act of 2013. Now, this does a lot of things. Here are three of its provisions. It basically eliminates SAMHSA funding for recovery-oriented, consumer-driven programs, including protection and advocacy, disability rights protection and advocacy programs. And, you know, and there's no new money in this, you know, Representative Mercy, so we don't have to do that. Let's just reconfigure things a little bit, put the doctors back in charge, and give states block grants to administer mandatory involuntary outpatient commitment programs. Really? So does outpatient commitment work? Where does Congressman Murphy get the idea that that would fix mental health care in the United States? Well, some researchers at Duke University have, we've studied this for many years, maybe a couple of decades. We've done studies on outcomes that matter to systems like hospitalization and arrest and outcomes that matter to people like perceived coercion and quality of life. And it still hasn't been implemented very widely at all, except in one place in New York where there was a huge appropriation of services to improve the service capacity. So, you know, our evidence suggests that it works. After all these years, but it's conditioned on investment in effective implementation, availability of intensive community-based services, and, you know, has to be put in place for long enough to matter. So am I for outpatient commitment as an evidence-based solution? Well, I'm both for it and against it at the same time. I mean, I'm for it as a part of a continuum of care and a system that's well-resourced. And if it's targeted to the right people, a small group of people who otherwise would be under more restrictive care, I'm against it as a kind of a crisis-driven, knee-jerk response to a mass shooting in a state that says we're going to fix mental health care and mass shootings and gun violence at the same time. Meanwhile, the system that they have is overburdened and fragmented and under-resourced. It doesn't work very well for people, and it's being held together by duct tape. And they think this is going to come in. It would be like, you know, this, like telling a person in a wheelchair at the bottom of a staircase, you know, we're going to pass a law to force you to get up those stairs, but we're not going to build a ramp. That's, why would we do that? But that's what we do with mental health care. Here's outpatient commitment, but we're not going to, you know, provide psychiatrists and case managers or even a hospital bed come to that. Here's another example. Legally requiring colleges and universities to have threat assessment and management teams. Now, this is on the, these have been around since 1994. The idea is you bring together representatives from these different administrative entities on a campus to try to address the problem of the risk of targeted violence on a campus. So you've got the campus police and the counseling service and the, you know, faculty and student affairs and human resources, the university council, if they're available. And they come together, they take referrals from students that people are concerned about, and they try to gather information, they come up with a solution that's going to be tailor-made to that person. It could range from monitoring the person to mandated treatment to all the way to involuntary medical leave. And about, you know, 75% of public universities have these in some form. They're all over the place. You know, there are two theories about how they work. One is a sort of fall through the cracks theory where you have these on the college campus landscape, these different entities, you know, that deal with students and student well-being, but they don't connect very well. They don't talk to each other, and so students can fall through the cracks. And the threat assessment team is going to do this, kind of build this fabric to cover over those cracks. The second theory is a kind of connect the dots theory. So a campus police officer might see something like this, and a teacher sees something that looks a little different. A counselor sees another picture, a resident advisor seems this, and none of these pictures raises any concern by themselves, but if they are brought together, they combine their pictures, and then you can connect the dots, and you might see something that looks like this, so that communication among team members can identify a student who might really pose a serious danger to himself or to the campus community. Do these work? Are these evidence-based? Well, they're a sort of face validity. They seem like a good idea. There's a derivative of literature about threat assessment, but it's kind of contested. There are lots and lots of people who have the same risk factors and look just like people who make threats, but never actually do. There are descriptive studies of the cases that threat assessment teams have dealt with, but we don't have any controlled studies. It's hard to know if someone who poses a threat and is there's intervention, if they would have progressed but for the intervention of the threat assessment team. We do know sometimes when they don't work in a spectacular way, like Dr. F is a psychiatrist. She was on the threat assessment team at University of Colorado, and she was concerned about J.H., and she made a report to the threat assessment team. J.H., for his part, went and bought an assault weapon, dropped out of the university's neurosciences program, and didn't tell anybody why. The threat assessment team didn't pursue this. Why? Because he wasn't a student anymore. And J.H. went into a crowded movie theater in Aurora and perpetrated the worst mass shooting in U.S. history. Three states have laws that mandate these things. Virginia 2008, Illinois 2008, and Connecticut in 2013. They're all pretty much the same. Virginia mandates just public institutions to do this, exempts private, and Illinois and Connecticut have these laws requiring all institutions of higher education to have threat assessment teams. Now, why did these laws pass here? Was it because some researchers sat down and contacted the legislatures? Was it because these states actually looked at the research and said, hey, well, let's do this? No, actually, there's only one reason. The one reason was in each state, there was a horrible mass shooting. Virginia Tech in 2007, Northern Illinois University in 2008, and Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. That's why these laws were passed. Do we know if legally requiring threat assessment teams works? Well, not really. We don't have any controlled studies of the effects on campus safety, but people are doing them anyway. We do know that in Virginia, where only the public institutions are affected, that 100% of them have them, and the private institutions only 77. So you can say that maybe the law actually, you know, requires and increases the percentage that have them. Maybe that's a good thing. Let me just end here with the staircase. So, I mean, it's kind of a cartoon, but it makes a good point. A couple of good points. One is that this is hard work, and we need to be in it for the long run. There needs to be a conversation between policymaking and research that's a two-way street. I mean, there needs to be a transmitter and a receiver turned on. You know, sometimes we need a translator. Sometimes we need, you know, some kind of a therapist maybe. But we need to have this conversation. And evidence-based policy is important. But research-informed policy and policy that relies on evidence are equally important. And it's a conversation that is worth having.